So that we all are on the same page today, Council, I'm going to have my marshals show you how we're keeping time so you can see what it looks like before I call the case and we begin. So you will begin when you see the start sign. Won't have a friendly light, and then you'll see the 5-minute sign, and at last, the stop sign. If you don't notice the last sign, I likely will let you complete your thought, but I really won't let you start into a new argument. So, and don't be concerned or figure you've done something inappropriate if you miss the stop sign. It's not always that easy when you're all involved in an argument and answering questions from the court. So as with my own participation, when you begin, be sure that your mute button is off. And so now I will call our first case, our second case, State versus Nash. And Attorney Olson, I think you are up. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
May it please the court. I'm Jeffrey Olson. I'm with the State Public Defender's Office Appellate Division in Madison. And we're here today to address the rule of a case decided 50 years ago now this year, North Carolina versus Alford. That is the case, of course, that held that a defendant is not constitutionally required to admit his or her guilt when entering a guilty plea. What is necessary is that the plea be knowing and voluntary, even if the defendant does not or cannot admit guilt to the charges. This court did not take up whether Alford pleas are usable or permitted in Wisconsin until 1995, although in the meantime, the Court of Appeals had decided in 1981 in State versus Johnson that there was no impediment to a circuit judge taking an Alford plea in its discretion. Alford made it clear, and all the cases make it clear, that these are purely within the discretion of the circuit court to accept or not. In the intervening years since Alford was decided, there's been very little case law actually addressing Alford pleas, partly that I think that is because they're not that common. As my brief cites, the only statistics I could find, they're between 6% and 8% of cases that are guilty pleas across the legal systems that keep track. But the issue that has come up in a couple of the cases, in the few cases that have been decided, involve the factual basis for the Alford plea and how a circuit court should make a sufficient factual basis. Obviously, under 97108, under the constitutional standards for a guilty plea, there's got to be sufficient factual basis. In the ordinary guilty plea, that's typically about the judge making sure that the facts alleged and the facts the defendant is admitting or at least is not challenging constitute the crime charged. That's part of ascertaining that the defendant understands the nature of the charges and that he's not pleading to something that he's pleading guilty to something that's not really a crime based on his admitted conduct. So in the Alford context, of course, that's going to be different because the defendant isn't admitting any guilt and is explicitly challenging his or her guilt. And the rule that's developed, as both Mr. Callis and I explain in our briefs, is that to establish a factual basis in an Alford plea, the circuit court has to be satisfied that there is strong proof of guilt or strong evidence of guilt. And it's not further defined except maybe by what it's not. The cases also make it clear that strong proof of guilt is not the same as beyond a reasonable doubt, which of course makes sense because that's the standard for a jury trial.
Counsel, how much does your argument depend on us changing what we require? I know you make an argument about using our superintending authority, but It seems that, you know, here you've got some pretty decent evidence with an attached police report, the offer of proof, you know, the other facts in the complaint. Again, the police report being attached to it. That would pretty much, under our current standard, make this a pretty easy disposition. And so I'm wondering, do you disagree with that proposition under current, you know, sort of under our current approach that the evidence presented here over that two-day hearing would be sufficient, including that offer of proof and the attached police report? So do you accept that proposition, or is your case mostly or entirely resting upon us changing the standard, you know, a la your request that we use our superintending authority to require testimony, et cetera?
Well, I'm going to preface my answer by saying I don't think there was a police report attached to the complaint. And that's something I think we'll probably get into at some point. Some counties do that. They basically write a complaint and attach all the police reports. So basically all the evidence that the defendant will get in discovery is attached to the complaint. This one was different. This was a summary of the forensic statements that the children made, and including some quotations of actual statements they made, but no police report, as far as I know. So just to make that clear, the offer of proof at the two plea hearings was, as I argue, essentially a summary or recitation or reiteration of what was already in the complaint. So that doesn't add anything new, it just summarizes it. My basic argument is that is not enough. What was in this complaint, what was in the probable cause portion of this complaint is not enough by itself. And the basis for that is both that the probable cause section is what is used in an ordinary guilty plea, or an ordinary guilty plea where the defendant is admitting guilt or not challenging guilt. That has always been sufficient to establish factual basis, but the case law is clear and the rationale for the rule is clear that strong proof of guilt or strong evidence of guilt requires more than what is going on in the ordinary situation because of the rejection or the refusal to admit guilt. And so what I'm asking the superintending authority, what I'm asking the court to use its authority to do is to say in an Alford plea, the complaint is not going to be enough and there must be more.
Counsel?
And then, with, then yes, go ahead.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to ask you, if we agree that there should be a new procedure that circuit courts should follow, even if we agree to exercise our superintending authority here, we would be establishing a new procedure that we have never mandated circuit courts to follow. In this case, our standard of review is erroneous exercise of discretion, so we look to uphold the circuit court's determination that there was a sufficient factual basis for the plea. But if we accept your argument, we would be imposing a new procedure that we haven't in the past. So wouldn't the remedy not be to allow your client to withdraw his plea, but to remand it to the court to conduct the type of proceeding that you are advocating we impose on circuit courts going forward?
Yes, that is the remedy. I said that in my reply brief. I receded from my request for relief in my opening brief. Mr. Callis's apt citation of State versus Loop convinced me that that would be the remedy. The circuit court, to be fair to the circuit court, if you adopt a new procedure or a new sort of hierarchy of procedures to use in a case, didn't have the benefit of that when this plea was taken some 3 or 4 years ago. And so it would be appropriate to remand for the court to use the new procedure to revisit the factual basis in this case and and determine whether there is strong proof of guilt under the new standard.
But could you address the, just one more question, please.
Okay, sure.
Can you address the argument that your new proposed procedure would effectively require the circuit court to conduct a bench trial, or at least a mini bench trial, as far as the presentation of evidence and witness testimony? And could you also address the argument that that would sort of deprive not only the state, but other people who have interests, like the victims, in not having to go through that type of procedure?
Sure. Yes, and obviously, that would be a concern if my proposal would mandate a sort of mini trial in every case. And as I tried to be clear initially and in my reply brief, it is not going to be required in every case. And the reasons for that are, I guess, sort of threefold. One is that I'm not asking the court to change the basic rule that governs all circuit court plea-taking procedures when it comes to factual basis, which is that establishing a factual basis is within the discretion of the court. It's got to decide how best to do that in the given case. And that leads to the second rationale, which is strong proof of guilt is determined in relationship to what the defendant is disputing about the charge. And essentially, as Alford put it, and as our cases have also made clear because they rely on Alford, is that the evidence has to be strong enough to substantially negate the defendant's claims of innocence. And so it's the substantial negation of the claim of innocence that will guide the circuit court in deciding what it needs to do to establish factual basis. And of course, the parties, because the parties are part of this, they're going to the plea hearing as well. And so in a case where, for instance, as I refer to in my reply brief, and I'll also cite Spears, S-P-E-A-R-S, in 147 with second, those were cases where there was essentially a dispute about one element in the case, in the charge the defendant was pleading to. And so the determination and the focus of the facts relevant to that element were what drove or what should drive what the court needs to do to determine factual basis. In Anina.
So, but if the challenge is, I never did any of these things, which is essentially what is the challenge here, don't you then have to have in-person testimony by the victims so that the trial court can weigh the credibility of their statements?
And that's the other extreme. In a case
well,
where...
Well, that's where we are, though, in this
and
case.
That's where we are in this case. And that's where I think we would be in some other cases. For instance, one that...
Mr. Olson, let me ask you a question to just springboard off of that. What rights do you think the victims would have in that instance?
Well, they would have the rights they have under current law. I mean, under the existing procedure, they had have the right, obviously, to be notified at the plea hearing that they might be called as a witness.
So under the scheme that you are proposing to this court, if there is a defendant who, number one, isn't going to take responsibility for a crime, and number two, is going to dispute all the facts, then we are going to re-traumatize, as would happen in this case, young children, victims of sexual assault, so that he can escape taking responsibility for what happened. Why shouldn't we just have a jury trial?
Well, you know, the court, as the state, part of the state's argument in response to this proposal, is it means people won't do Alford pleas as much. because they'll just say, fine, if you can't admit guilt or at least plead no guilt or no contest, go to trial. But a full-blown trial is far more onerous on everybody, the court system, the witnesses, the victim.
I'm sorry, Mr. Olson, but I think anytime a child victim of sexual assault walks into a courtroom, whether it is to be forced to testify at a sentencing hearing for someone who isn't taking responsibility or at a trial, that is traumatizing to them. It makes no difference to them when they have to walk into the courtroom. The trauma, the re-traumatization to them is the same. And what you are, part of your argument here, you talk about using a testimony from preliminary hearings. I'm not sure we could point to the last time a sexual assault victim testified at a prelim in this state since the law was changed allowing hearsay. So is there some other way that we, under your scheme, that we could get this information without re-traumatizing people?
The videos, the child advocacy videos, which were done in this case, and which, if there were a trial, would be the primary method of giving the jury the victim's testimony anyway. Under the assumption they're admissible under 90808, which most are, because we have professionals out there who do these videos and know the law and follow it carefully. And in any event, in doing a factual basis, the rules of evidence aren't going to apply. The court could review the videos even separate from the plea hearing itself to save time. And these videos in this case were not actually submitted. The state had filed a notice that it intended to use them and was going to ask the court to rule on admissibility. Typically, that's not done unless there's a firm trial, and often it's not done until the first day of trial.
Okay, so is it your position?
The videos would certainly give that kind of demeanor and fullness of the statement that we don't get from the criminal complaint.
In my review of the record, it looked to me like the ADA summarized what was in the videos.
There were brief quotations from the videos in the complaint, which was what the court used for the factual basis. You don't get the full picture at all from what's in the complaint about how the videos went, how direct, how detailed, how compelling, what have you. Those very things that you don't get from a cold record in the appellate courts don't come out in that criminal complaint.
What about the statements that the ADA made in court to the judge on both days of this plea hearing?
My argument is that those were little more than brief summaries of what those statements were. It didn't even quote the specific language that's in the criminal complaint itself.
Mr. Olson, I have two things. Well, we're weighing and struggling with, and I'm hearing Justice Krofsky and I share the same concerns about re-traumatizing victims. I also look at the actual record here made by the circuit court judge, and there isn't that language in the findings of strong evidence of guilt, and I will give you that. And that's concerning to me too. Is there a middle ground here for this court to reach? We're hesitant to exercise our superintending authority. You probably know that more than anyone, having read all of our cases. But is there a way to not give a script, because we don't do that either, but talk about how the findings actually have to be made? And maybe just doing that would have had this judge be more specific and tie the different pieces to each element, because the language in our case law is that it has to be strong evidence of guilt on each element. So would that be something that would be helpful to improving the entire process?
Well, I think it certainly would be an improvement, because you're right that there was no reference to strong proof of guilt at all in this plea hearing. And I don't see Alford pleas often in my practice, but when I do see them, that's typical. Sometimes the judge is not aware it's really an Alford plea until they're in the middle of the plea hearing. Nobody's really made it very clear. And sort of advising or requiring the parties and the courts to be much more clear going into the plea what this is about, and the need to do more than you usually do in accepting a guilty plea. And as you say, going to each element, that's absolutely necessary, but that's necessary in any plea, guilty, no contest, or Alford. And if you go that route, I would urge you also to make it clear that this strong proof of guilt is directly related to the need to substantially negate the claims of innocence. And that will require some explanation from defense counsel or the defendant about what the dispute is with the state's case. And Chief Justice Rogensack is absolutely right. In a case where the defendant is saying, I didn't do this, this never happened, that's going to be a much different case than, for instance, Spears, where the dispute was whether the defendant who admitted driving and killing two people because of his driving was fighting about one element, namely whether he was showing utter disregard for human life in the way he drove. And so advising the courts that they're going to have to know some of that information in advance, and that in cases where there's got to be some assessment of credibility, of demeanor, where there's a broader claim of innocence that's going to depend on testimony, that then they'll at least have that up front. And that in the cases like this one, where there's a child sexual assault allegation, and there have been videos done as part of the investigation, that those can substitute for live testimony. I would also point out, and I maybe my briefs didn't make this clear enough, but you know, technology has changed how a lot of this evidence is preserved. I mean, there's so much more evidence now on video and audio. You know, witness statements, not just of children, but of others, are commonly given to us in discovery on video or audio form. We've got surveillance video, you know.
What about the defendant's claim, which we see in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. because the allegation is that counsel was ineffective? Oh, well, if my lawyer had questioned her about this and this and raised this and this issue, she would have testified differently than what's in the video. So if you use a video, I'm not going to have a chance to raise those arguments. What about that?
Well, I don't think that's a concern for this reason. If the defendant and his or her lawyer have concluded that the best resolution to this case is an Alford plea, then they've basically should have made an assessment that the state's evidence as it stands, without subject to challenge by cross-examination or contrary evidence, is strong proof of guilt. And you're taking advantage of the Alford plea to reduce your exposure and or get a better sentencing recommendation. And the last thing you're going to want to do is challenge that those statements at the plea hearing and basically block the plea. You know, in terms of an ineffective claim afterwards, well, you know, that could happen in any scenario. It could happen in a guilty plea scenario where the guilty plea is claimed to be invalid because it was not properly counseled, because trial counsel didn't do enough investigation to come up with evidence that would have been usable at trial to impeach the state's witnesses. So, you know, that's a common concern in every context, Alford, no contest, guilty, and of course at trial itself.
Counsel, I'm of the mind that maybe we should get rid of Alford, please. As I recall, Alford a U.S. Supreme Court case said states don't have to allow them. And in Garcia, several references to judges don't have to accept them. And there seems to be such an amorphous sort of thing. We were talking about sexual assault cases and special care. Well, you've got a Court of Appeals case, X. Rel. Warren versus Schwartz, 1998, that takes it from the other perspective, not the victim's perspective, but hey, shouldn't the defendant be warned, that that case indicates, in a colloquy, that if he maintains his innocence, that that could affect his ability to successfully complete probation? Special care should be given in sexual assault cases. There are so many problems with Alford pleas. I looked at the special materials. The special materials, and I'm referring to the SM32A. They said, well, Alford plea should, the consequences of an Alford plea should be just like a no contest plea. In fact, it would, and that is, it can't be used later, you know, against you, so to speak. And yet other places we say, well, it's a strong evidence of guilt, so it is a finding of guilt and you can use it against you. I mean, the law is undeveloped and and the approaches are inconsistent. So let's just get rid of the darn thing. What do you say to that?
Well, my initial response is I didn't brief that. So
no.
my thinking is, I don't know that if I, can I just?
Yeah, you can finish your thought, of course.
Thank you. I think I would stand on the reasoning in Garcia. It has, for all the problems, they have a real purpose in the system. And the state wasn't asking to get rid of them either. And I think Garcia's reasoning is as valid for keeping them today as it was in 1995.
Well,
thank
you. Very good. Okay. Attorney Kellis, are you ready to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General John Kellis, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, State of Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Constitution confers upon this court that superintending authority to impose rules upon its lower courts. Certainly we're here because Nash wants this court to exercise that authority to impose a new rule upon circuit courts to accept an Alford, but basically limits the acceptance of an Alford plea unless the state first presents some or all of its trial evidence during an evidentiary hearing. I'm here to ask that you decline this invitation to impose such an unnecessary and radical rule. And there are two overarching concepts that I'd like to address today. First and foremost, I want to explain the reasons why Nash's proposed rule is unnecessary, it's mandated by no authority, and it's detrimental to the administration of justice, which demonstrates why this court should not exercise its significant superintending power here. With any remaining time, secondly, I'd like to explain why the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court were correct when they found that the facts contained in the record were more than sufficient to establish a factual basis for Mr. Nash's plea.
Counsel, before you get into those two points, do you agree that the colloquy here did not include this circuit court judge actually finding strong evidence of guilt on each of the elements? And at the very least, even if we can go back and say now, yes, it was there, shouldn't this court confirm or affirm what it's already said in the past about the importance of the judge actually making those findings?
I agree that it's important that a court ensures that there's a factual basis. However, I don't know if the specific terminology, using the magic words, is really the important factor here. I think as long as there is that strong factual basis that's presented, I don't necessarily know if a court specifically proclaiming, I am affirmatively finding that there is a strong factual basis or strong proof of guilt, that really is a make or break finding. As long as there are sufficient facts in the record, I think that is sufficient both for the court to accept the plea and for the post-conviction court to reject the invitation or the request to withdraw the plea.
Well, then doesn't this put this on the same footing as a regular guilty plea? I mean, this is a special plea. This is a situation where a defendant gets to maintain his innocence, something that we don't allow when we're taking a guilty plea, yet because of the special circumstances, still gets to take advantage of a potential reduced sentence or lesser sentence, or at least offer from the state. So why wouldn't we, as we've laid out in our case law, require those findings to be made the same way we require a factual basis to be made in a regular guilty plea?
Well, I think that there is the finding of the factual basis. I do think that there is this misconception, albeit I recognize that the factual requirements to accept an Alford plea are higher than a traditional plea of guilty or no contest. I think the mistake that we sometimes make is assuming that the facts or the evidence presented at a traditional non-Alford plea hearing falls above the requirement for that plea, but below the Alford plea. And what I mean by that is certainly there are criminal complaints that are relied upon when a defendant enters this plea. Some of them are extremely meager. We're talking about just the bare bones, minimal threshold, absolute very fewest facts that could be presented. And maybe that's not going to be enough for an Alford plea. However, when you have a criminal complaint such as Mr. Nash's that highlights all of the allegations, that explains all of the details as to why it is that he is guilty, I don't think that there is that same concern that we have this meager factual basis that somehow falls in between where the traditional guilty, no contest plea factual basis is and where that heightened Alford plea standard is.
Attorney Kellis, is your understanding in this case, based on the record, that part of what the judge relied upon included the motion in limine about the other victim?
Just Scrofsky, I don't necessarily know if at the time the court is relying on that. Certainly those facts are in the record. I think the bigger question here, because really what this comes down to is the manifest injustice test and whether he established a manifest injustice to withdraw his plea, is at that time, not necessarily at the time of the plea, but at this stage, are there facts in the record that establish a sufficient factual basis or that strong evidence of guilt? So while I recognize that the court could have been certainly better, the circuit court certainly could have been better about explaining, I am taking into consideration these seven different things that have been presented to me in the past, I don't think that that's necessarily, that doesn't bring us to the point where this is a manifest injustice. If that were the case, authorities such as Loop and the cases that have allowed for a remand to establish that, they wouldn't be properly decided, because in effect, there should never be an opportunity to ever supplement the factual basis or show what the court relied on after the fact. So I do think it's important that they present the facts or certainly stress what is being relied upon. But ultimately, this is a manifest injustice case. And what we're asking is, at this stage, are there facts in evidence or are there sufficient facts in the record that would support the acceptance of that plea? So what I wanted to address in regards to the exercise of this court's superintending authority, this court, as it's already been referenced in today's argument, is that it's not exercised lightly. It's very rare that it's done so. And it's used in situations where there is no other adequate remedy or where the trial court's conduct threatens to impose a significant hardship on a citizen. Neither of those are present here. As to the adequate remedy, it's important to recall, again, why the court is required to establish a factual basis. Certainly, Mr. Olson and I, in our respective briefs, I don't disagree. There are various interests that are served. One of them, which was recognized by this court in Thomas, was making sure that we don't have a naive defendant pleading to a crime without understanding how his conduct either satisfied or didn't satisfy the elements. We don't want an individual in that position to be pleading or for the court accepting that plea. Certainly in the Alford context, we also have the concern of we don't want a person pleading guilty to a crime where there's really no facts to support it, and they're just doing it to avoid a trial penalty or what's been considered a trial penalty. But as much as both interests are important, the question here isn't whether Nash's proposed rule could serve a purpose. You know, certainly this court could, I'm sure, come up with a best practice for circuit courts and how they do every day-to-day task. And you know, in the Alford plea context, certainly the court could do something similar to what Nash is asking and say that the court needs to convene what amounts to a mini bench trial or something similar to a bench trial. And the argument might have some merit if that were the only way to ensure a sufficient factual basis. But precedent in Wisconsin and 46 other states that allow for Alford pleas proves that that's simply not the case. If we want to talk about where, you know, Mr. Nash, at least the briefing has stressed that, well, in Alford and these other cases, there was this presentation of evidence. And that's true, but that doesn't mean that sets the bar for what the lowest threshold can be for a sufficient Alford plea. And that's where I pointed out in State versus Anina, we recognize a situation where there's a dispute, but the prosecutor just read from a police report. None of the officers were present to testify. None of the facts were enlisted by any of the individuals who were actually involved. And yet the court still found that that was sufficient. I don't know how you can reconcile Anina with Nash's proposed rule. There were no witnesses. Sorry?
You see this essentially as a sufficiency of evidence case. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if I understand, Justice Bradley.
Several times in your comments, most recently about four sentences ago, you talked about sufficiency, evidence that's sufficient. And I just turned that and say sufficiency of evidence. And I think one can advance that this is kind of a sufficiency of evidence. Is there enough there for strong evidence of guilt, right? But generally speaking, sufficiency of evidence cases are not the kind of cases that we take. So let's say we want to improve the law, and there's so much room for improvement. What would you recommend that this court do vis-a-vis the Alford plea? When the Garcia case was before the court, in a footnote we said, help, criminal jury instruction committee, we need some standard uniformity of questions to ask and focus. Well, we didn't get that, you know. Take a look at the plea advisement and waiver of rights form. A question earlier was referencing ineffective assistance of counsel. Well, oftentimes a case is decided because you can look to the plea advisement and waiver of rights form. And even though maybe the colloquy isn't decent enough or the defense attorney didn't do a great explanation, it's all there in the form. Alford plea isn't even mentioned in a plea advisement form. Are they supposed to check no contest? Are they supposed to check guilty? What are they supposed to check? And what are the consequences of it? Let me use the term kind of collateral consequences. I don't mean some of the collateral consequences that we talk about in terms of loss of employment and licensure, but what does it mean to have an Alford plea? Can it be used against you later? I don't know. You read the special materials. It does. I don't know. I don't know, they don't know, we don't know. So give us some help. What should we be using this case for to advance the rule of law?
You know, I think the best thing that this court can do, and I certainly don't think that this maybe isn't the answer you're specifically looking for by any means, but it's to reinstill that circuit courts have discretion to address a particular plea and look at the record before it and decide if the facts are sufficient. I don't know if there's a specific way to, I'm sorry?
I just said sufficiency of evidence.
Well, sure. And I mean, I guess it really, if the defendant has some type of, I don't know, in circumstances such as Mr. Nash's, he was very clear, this just didn't happen. There's no DNA evidence, and this is a quote-unquote hearsay case. He didn't like the fact that he had multiple accusers and that somehow he could be found guilty based on their word when there's no DNA evidence. You know, certainly, in contrast to that, you know, the state had presented the criminal complaint that provided detailed summaries of what the witnesses had come forth. I don't know if there's a way, just because as Mr. Olson and I have, I think, pretty much are in agreement on, is that what's going to happen and what's going to be necessary in any specific case is it's going to be case dependent. And that's why I think that a specific rule such as the one he's proposing doesn't make any sense. If it were so straightforward that this is the type of thing that needs to be employed in every case, maybe that would be a fit situation to impose such a rule. But that's not the case.
The general thrust of your argument, as I hear it, you know, it seems to be the law is reasonably well established as it is, and maybe there's not so much to do here. There's no big problem that needs to be fixed. That the record here was enough for the trial court to make the finding that it did, which is sufficient. And the finding is what it is, of strong evidence, and that's that. Is that a fair enough characterization?
It is, Justice Hagedorn, and I mean, really, obviously, how this appeal started in the Court of Appeals and how it's advanced to this stage is quite a different animal. And I say that because when we're starting, we're talking about, well, was the manifest injustice established here? And I think the best evidence or the best proof that we have that there was no manifest injustice established is we're now trying to change the rules to make sure that there was a manifest injustice. And that is to say there should be this rule. And because they didn't apply the rule in this case, there's a problem. And I don't think that given the facts of this case, and again, it could be very different in a different case. I mean, I, as a former prosecutor, I mean, there were certainly times where we had a criminal complaint that was very meager and just cut right to the chase, provided minimal details, and that may not be sufficient for an Alford plea. And I'm not here to dispute that. But when you have the facts that are here, it's sufficient. And if the court decides upon looking at the criminal complaint and says, you know, I'm sorry, counsel, you're a little light on facts here, I'm going to need to see more, that presents the opportunity for the court to dictate, well, what do we need to see here? What is missing here for me to find this strong factual basis? But I think I don't see how it doesn't evade a bright line or a specific rule that this court could impose on all the circuit courts.
I thought perhaps Justice Bradley was going to ask this question of you, and she didn't. So I will ask, do you think we should get rid of Alford, please? What's the state's position?
I won't say that the Alford pleas should be eliminated. I think that they have their place. Certainly, it's unfortunate when they lead to post-conviction litigation, as it did in this case. I mean, I have, again, as a former prosecutor, there were times where you don't, you know, it's certainly not a great end result or as good of an end result as you could have when you have victims that are appearing at a hearing expecting someone to take responsibility, to hear them find every reason to say, no, I didn't do it, but I want the deal anyways. You know, is the court going to be taking that lack of accountability in regard and imposing a harsher sentence because of that? I mean, there are certainly issues that I think come along with Alford pleas. At the same time, it's, you know, the hope is, at least absent the adoption of this rule, the hope is that, you know, there are cases where the state is trying to protect a victim. We don't want to put the victim through the trial. And in the end, if we can have that assurance that a case can be resolved and that justice can be served without putting the victim or witnesses through the trial or the evidentiary proceedings, it serves its purpose. And I, you know, I don't want to discredit that portion or that value of it. But I'd be lying if I said that Alford Pleas certainly, as evidenced by this very case, they present issues.
Well, there's a new standard, and I'm not sure actually how new it is, relatively new, and I don't have the date. Perhaps you know of a new standard they adopted in Minnesota. And Mr. Olson, I meant to ask you about that, and if there's time, just to give you a heads up. Are you familiar with that, Mr. Attorney Kellis? Do you think that? What's your feelings about that? Because if I understand your answer to Justice Hagedorn, it's things are okay as they are, and the question in this case is whether or not there was a manifest injustice. And Mr. Olson, I think the standard that he and Mr. Nash are putting forward is more of a mini trial, for just trying to think of a short way to explain it. It seems to me that the Minnesota standard perhaps is somewhere in the middle. And I'm wondering what your response is to that standard.
And Justice Krofsky, my apologies. I am not familiar with the Minnesota standard that's been utilized. All I was aware of, by virtue of going through these, trying to find any case at all that has ever adopted anything close to what Nash is proposing in this case, I haven't been able to find one. Which I guess, you know, also. That's not to say that simply because no court has adopted a rule previously that there could never be a chance that it's a rule that could be employed with some success. That said, I think it speaks volumes to the fact that of the, like I said, I think 47 jurisdictions that employ Alford Pleas, none of them employ this type of rule. So unfortunately, I can't answer the question as posed, just because I'm not exactly sure what the state of Minnesota employs.
I can lay it out very quickly. There's an establishment on the record with the judge where they ask about the underlying conduct. They put evidence that there's a colloquy, and the judge and the defendant talk about the evidence the state would likely introduce at trial. There's the possibility of introducing a witness statement or other evidence into the record. There's the possibility of abbreviated testimony from witnesses, and then there's a stipulation by the parties as to a factual basis. And at the end, the defendant admits that the evidence likely to be introduced by the state is evidence that is likely to convict him or her.
And that's all for an Alford plea, correct?
Yes.
See, I don't necessarily know if that will even be sufficient. And the reason why I say that is, even towards the end of when you were explaining the various steps, it's difficult to see how, I mean, I guess Mr. Nash finally acknowledged towards the very end that the evidence or that the facts were sufficient. He did admit that several times. But I guess I don't really see a big difference between what Minnesota is instituting versus, I guess, what Nash is proposing here. The bottom line is that if credibility is really the biggest concern, and the fact that the criminal complaint and any police reports, things like that, if those are insufficient, and if credibility is really the main issue here, he has an avenue, and that is to proceed to trial. And I don't know, I mean, I certainly understand a person in Mr. Nash's shoes with the evidence that was there, I understand why he doesn't want to take responsibility and admit what he did, but the options are there. He either can enter his plea or he can proceed to trial, and no amount of rules that the court can institute is really going to change that. So what I will say is, you know, as far as certainly no state employs this particular type of rule, Anina seems to have recognized that it's, at least in Wisconsin, seems to have recognized that it's certainly not required. We talked a little bit, I know that there was some comments regarding, you know, having the victims have to testify. And, you know, there's certainly, that's not the only problem that we really have here. I mean, it's it really does discourage the acceptance of these pleas for a number of different reasons. I mean, for one, I don't know what motivation a circuit court really has to accept a plea when it recognizes that there's going to be post-conviction litigation regarding the acceptance of this plea no matter what happens. Because even if we do present some type of facts, there's always going to be that argument after the fact that it shouldn't have been believed for some reason, or, you know, as was alluded to earlier, that my counsel was ineffective because they didn't present, you know, some type of conflicting witness. It certainly puts the defense attorney in a tough position because I don't know how they're supposed to go about doing their jobs. Either they impeach the witness and the plea gets rejected, or they sit on their hands and they're alleged to be ineffective for not doing enough to impeach the witness. I don't see how, even with the creation of this rule, it's not going to cut down on post-conviction litigation. All it's going to do is require victims and witnesses to come in to relive these experiences. It's going to take up more time in the court's calendar. And it's all because Mr. Nash couldn't admit to the fact that he did these crimes. And I don't know how instituting that rule is really the appropriate route to go. And I will say, you know, the bottom line is, and I know that this seems, you know, the fact that the court accepted this case, there may have been some concerns about, well, should we be doing something? Should we be clarifying something? Should we put some type of guidance out there? And, you know, although I certainly think it's helpful if a court uses certain buzzwords and says, I'm finding strong evidence of guilt, to at least clue in everyone that we're viewing this as an Alford plea, you know, I think it really needs to be left to the court's discretion, just like any factual basis finding is, that would not normally be disturbed absent an erroneous exercise of discretion, and allow the courts to make the case-by-case findings, look at the evidence, look at the facts that were presented, and if more needs to be presented, that's fine. At that point, the question can be posed. Maybe the prosecutor has additional reports. Maybe there could be some type of stipulations, even if the defendant has some, you know, maybe the defendant misunderstands how the law applies and their dispute is something that really isn't about how the facts meet it, but they just don't quite understand how the elements met it. That can be addressed in the course of that plea proceeding. What I also wanted to address is just a little bit more about the specific. I mean, certainly the court took this case to address the proposed rule, but I think it's important to really stress just how little impact that rule, or how the rule would have really impacted in this case. For one, we had the criminal complaint, and in that criminal complaint, it detailed how we have three victims coming forward, providing details of when, where, and how Nash assaulted them. These weren't vague accounts of what actually occurred. We have one victim telling a rather grotesque story of how Nash forced his penis into her mouth. We have another victim who described at least two horrific assaults, one where he held her down, covered her mouth, and painfully contacted his private part to her private part. You know, another incident where Nash tried to pry her mouth open and insert his penis. And all of these facts were presented in the criminal complaint, and the prosecutor, again, kind of reiterated a lot of those facts in the statement made to the court. The Court of Appeals was correct to recognize that with all of those various facts, that they easily describe strong evidence of guilt. And I'd ask the court affirm, because absent establishing a never-before-used rule, there was strong evidence or strong factual basis there. But even so, the state wasn't done just by the facts in the criminal complaint. Again, when we're talking about the manifest injustice standard, we're talking about, at the time that there's this plea withdrawal, are there facts in the record that support it? And we also had the state informing the court and providing notice that the victim's recorded interviews would be presented, that Nash's Mirandized statement where he acknowledged some of the behavior, at least I believe the specific admission was licking one of the victim's nipples and being interrupted by his mother. You know, The court also had previously granted the other act's motion to introduce evidence of the assaults that didn't occur in Waukesha County. In reflection, reviewing all of those various facts, I don't see how there can be a manifest injustice unless the court decides to impose a rule and require more than what has ever been required in Wisconsin. And certainly Mr. Nash even recognized at the end of the hearing, at the end of his plea hearing, several times that there were enough facts that could result in his conviction. Ultimately, the circuit court was correct to accept his plea. And I somewhat want to wrap up by just saying if this court adopts Nash's proposed rule, it's not because any of the authority mandates as such. Exercising this court's superintending authority in this case, I don't see how it could be viewed as anything other than a vote of non-confidence for a court to be able to look at the facts of a specific case and make a judgment call on, are there sufficient facts here or do I need some additional showing? I maintain there's no reason to tread into those waters. And for those reasons, I would ask that the court decline to impose Nash's rule, trust the circuit courts to fulfill their duties, and affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal, are you ready to go with that, Attorney Olson?
Yes, Chief Justice, thank you. I'll start with a point of agreement before launching into my points of disagreement. Mr. Kellis is right. There's obviously no mandate here. That's why we're in the court. I tried to make it clear in my petition that we were asking the court to visit this issue because there isn't any authority, and only this court can set the authority in this manner. Picking up on the disagreement, this isn't a vote of, or it wouldn't be a vote of no confidence for this court to lay out more specific procedures for circuit courts to follow. I view this as trying to help the circuit courts deal with a plea they don't often see, that has a different rule, and that puts them in a bit of a bind because of that different rule. The standard for a factual basis for an Alford plea requires strong proof of guilt. That's the judge's obligation at the time of the plea. And right now, judges have no real idea how they're supposed to go about doing that, beyond knowing that it's something different than an ordinary guilty plea. And this brings up something Justice Bradley was asking about, or pointing out that there isn't much guidance for circuit courts on this. I will tout the work of the jury instruction committee, criminal jury instruction committee, a little bit. They did just revise SM32 and SM32A and updated them last summer. So they're constantly trying to provide that kind of guidance to the circuit court. There is a fairly lengthy discussion in SM32A about taking or establishing a factual basis. So there's some discussion out there, at least about the legal standards, but in the terms of how to do it, there's really nothing. The cases and the whole reason I got off on this idea is because of the way courts did establish factual basis in past cases, starting with Alford itself, where there was testimony. Where that testimony showed such strong evidence that the reviewing courts and the circuit judge who took his plea were convinced that there was, that his decision to forego a trial despite his assertion of innocence was perfectly reasonable under all the circumstances, a knowing and voluntary choice between alternatives. And so giving the circuit judges a better process or better guidelines on what they're supposed to do when faced with one of these pleas can only help them. I'm also want to push back on this, the sort of references to evidentiary hearing or mini evidentiary hearing or mini trial. Just to be absolutely clear, I am not saying and cannot say that that's going to be required in every case. again, the circuit court has discretion in how it determines factual basis. And this will be part and parcel of that. But the reason why more guidance is needed here is because of that requirement for strong proof of guilt that substantially negates the claim of innocence. And so,
can I just ask you something on that point?
Sure.
So, and I use the term mini trial because I was just trying to summarize your argument, and I don't mean to do that as an unfair characterization.
Sure.
But part of what you did put forth was to have possibly someone testify. And I think because of the nature of sexual assault cases in general, especially child sexual assault cases, where we all know that a delayed reporting is more common than not, that you are going to, in those cases especially, have these issues of credibility like you have in this case. You're also going to have issues of where really the proof is going to be the statements. So what are we going to do if we're going to guide circuit court judges? How do we guide them when they run into the issue of having perhaps one of these victims testify and then there is still issues of credibility? So what if one of these victims had testified and Mr. Nash continued to say, I don't believe her?
This is another point I wanted to make and that I also tried to make in my reply brief. This isn't about convincing Mr. Nash of his guilt or of any other defendant who's entering an Alford plea. This is about the judge. This is about the circuit court who has to find strong evidence of guilt that substantially negates the claim of innocence. This isn't a therapy session for the defendant. It's the circuit court assuring there's a substantial factual basis to make sure the plea is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And I see my time is up.
It is.
Thank you, Justice.
Yeah. Thank you both. And thank you for participating in oral arguments under this new format. You both did a very good job. So it's quite helpful to the court to have you here. So we will conclude this hearing now. The court will meet in closed session at 1:30. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.